me to now introduce our guest speaker, Thomas Hollywood H.
My ears did when I used to use. It used to buzz like that. Huh? You ever have a ring like that? My name is Thomas Henderson, and I'm an alcoholic who abused cocaine. I'm glad to be here tonight. Me and my friend came down here, and I went down to Tijuana today. I thought I wouldn't see this shit no more for a while. But you know how it is. I'm glad to be here in San Diego tonight for Cocaine Anonymous. It's always a privilege for me to talk to cocaine addicts because you and I have something very much in common, and that is we did cocaine too much, too often, too long to be alive. My friend, somebody told me that Cocaine Anonymous is like the mafia, you know, you leave, you die. You know, I believe there are only two emotions, and that's love and fear. And you can't feel them both at the same time. And as a result of my sobriety today, I want to tell you right off, I'm not afraid anymore. Fear is not a part of my life today. And this program gave me that. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, so I'm going to tell you what it was like. I was raised in a dysfunctional home. I didn't learn what dysfunctional meant until I got to these rooms. I thought it was normal shit. My mother and father were both alcoholic. They drank alcoholically. They fought on weekends. And I thought that was normal stuff. Matter of fact, when I talk to kids today, I tell them about perceptions. Growing up, I perceived that alcohol was a way to have a good time. In other words, in order to have a good time in life, I had to be drinking, smoking, snorting, tooting, something. Because I saw my mother and father do that. Alcohol was my first drug of choice. Because it was the only drug I knew. But when I used alcohol in my early days, I never abused it. I just drank it because I was trying to get an early preview to adulthood. My mother and father drank every weekend and got drunk every weekend. And they fought. My mother was a tough little gal. My mother was 15 years old when she gave birth to me. And the guy she had made love to in order to make me was a guy that was in the military. And it was kind of like a one-night affair. And I was conceived. And I didn't see my father until I was 21 years old. So I grew up with my mother. And by the time I could really remember what was going on or figure out what was going on in life, I knew that guy in the house was not my father. I knew that because my mother made that perfectly clear many times. I remember at 4 or 5 years old, him coming after me for one reason or the other, and her saying, "That's not your child. Don't you put your damn hands on him." And that gave me power, but it also made me feel different. And apart from, because, you see, they started having children in the house. And my name was Thomas Edward Henderson. And their name was Nettie Lavinia Rivers, and then Victoria Jean Rivers, and then James Rivers Jr., and then Franchot Gray Rivers. And my name was Thomas Edward Henderson. Where the fuck did that name come from? So I don't know about you, but growing up, I felt apart from, I felt different, I felt, you know, I felt unwhole. Where is my father, mother? Well, your father's name is Billy, and he was in the military, and he's not here. She could never tell me where my dad was. She didn't know what state he was in. She didn't know if he was alive. She didn't know. I don't know about you, but growing up, man, I felt real bad, you know. And then my mother was kind of a fine little gal and flighty, you know what I mean? I'm 10 years old. My mother's only 25, so she's a hot little mama. And I used to, you know, she ran a cleaners in my neighborhood and then some after-hour joints. And I used to see men. She was friendly with men beside my stepdad. And I used to always think one of those guys was my father. I just never knew. At 12 years old, something very profound happened in my life. My mother and father, as they'd done every week. See, in my house, was kind of like WrestleMania. There was a fight every week, just a different winner. Well, this night was different. I was 12 years old. And my father straddled my mother, and he was beating her face to a pulp. I could hear the fist and the flesh meet. It was a thud hitting her. And they were both drunk. And she had bought him a gun for Christmas. So after he had beat her, he went out to the car to get a bottle or whatever. I'm 12 years old. I want to help her, but I can't. He's a big man. Well, they end up on the porch. My father's coming back. She's got the rifle in her hand. And she says to him, "Don't take another fucking step." And of course, the drunk that he was and the alcoholic that he was, he took another step. And she blew his ass off the porch with the rifle. Several things went through my little mind at that time. Number one, that alcohol had made my mother shoot my father. Number two, why did that fucker take another step? And I knew that alcohol had a lot to do with what had happened that night. That was my early association with alcohol and family. You know, my mom shot my dad, or my stepdad. It's really profound that I ended up being a National Football League all-star, pro bowler, superstar, because at an early age, I had nobody to take me to the ballpark to play catch with. I did all this on my own pretty much because I remember my stepdad, who wasn't really into sports. He'd been working since he was a kid, and he was from South Carolina. I remember one day, I was about 10, 11 years old, and he took me to the ballpark. I was playing Little League Baseball. You know, God knows I might have been a great baseball player, but my stepdad came to see me play one day, and I got in the batter's box, and I struck one, and I missed the ball, and strike two, and I missed the ball, and I struck out. And I heard behind the batter's cage a southern drawl voice cry out, "Boy, you the sorriest thing I ever seen." Well, that really didn't encourage me to pursue baseball. And I didn't want him around no more, you know. My mother and father stayed together for another 15 years. That's alcoholism and codependency at its best. I have to tell you also tonight that beside all that, Being a frightened little guy, not, without having a dad, I took a lot of walks and I cried a lot. I cried and I swore to God that I was going to be bigger and better and I was going to be stronger and I wanted to do this. And I got to tell you something very profound, I believe, is that I had dreams. And I want to tell you this. Every one of my dreams came true. And every one of my dreams broke when it came true. Isn't it wonderful to fantasize about something and wish for something? But when it comes true, it's kind of like an orgasm. All of my dreams came true and every one of my dreams broke. I wanted to play pro football. I wanted to go to the Super Bowl. I wanted to be all pro. I wanted to go to Hollywood. Well, hell, they named me Hollywood. Every one of my dreams came true. Every one of my dreams were broken. Because every time one of my dreams came true, I was never satisfied with it. I wanted something else. What do we call that? Obsessive compulsive? I left Austin after my mother got this reputation with the gun. After she shot my stepfather, it was Annie Oakley. She became, you know, this woman with the gun. My mother ran several after-hour joints. See, you know, and you're not so surprised how I turned out the way I turned out when I tell you where I came from. You see, because I was raised in a middle-class black neighborhood. Middle-class ghetto neighborhood. That just meant I was never hungry. It's not surprising I ended up addicted to something. Anyway, my mother was bootlegging and selling chicken at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and of course she started carrying the gun, and she had like a tattoo of the cylinders on her breast here. Now, I have to tell you, my mother is my significant other. Because I never had any real ties to my stepfather. The respect I have for him today and admiration is that he fed us as long as I was there. But my mother was my significant other. So it was like clockwork every Friday and Saturday night. My mother was shooting in the air or shooting at somebody at the club. And of course, I was a little pool shooter and hustler by now. And I'm drinking and I'm smoking a little pot at 12, 13, 14 years old. And I got to the point where I would even slap people. And you know my mother, you know. When I decided to leave home, my mother told me that I'll shoot you if you leave home. And I believed her. Now, she shot my father. I got to tell you this to follow up on that. In 1978, when I was playing for the Dallas Cowboys, I get a phone call at work one day. I go to the phone, pick up the phone. It's my mother. She's in jail. I said, Mother, what's happening? Well, she says, well, Papa Tom hit me across the head with a gun. I said, and? She said, I shot him 6 times. Well, Papa Tom was my grandfather. That's dysfunctional shit. That's not normal shit. So I finally broke away from home with these dreams and aspirations. All of a sudden, I don't know where it came from, I wanted to prove everybody wrong because, you see, I heard them whispering about me. I hung around the screen doors at night and listened to them play dominoes and talk about me. I was a little bastard without a dad. And I might was going to end up just a little street bum. He ain't going to be worth a damn. You see, I heard him talking about me. And I'd walk and I'd cry and I said, you know, what are you, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And I'd cry And I had things to do. I had to prove everybody wrong. So I had these dreams, and every one of them came true. I just didn't know what to do with the dream when it came true. They say, be careful what you pray for. God, let me win the lottery! What is it, $6 million tonight? I left home and I went to Oklahoma to live with my grandmother, Nettie Mae Higgins. And from there, I had kind of flunked out of high school. Well, six F's. Does that qualify? I think that'll get it. Six F's. So throughout my junior and senior year in high school, I had to go to night school, Sunday school, makeup school, give me a credit school, wherever they were having school, I was at it. And I finished with my class. Now, I can't tell you where I got that energy or that determination. I just wanted to finish with my class. And I finished high school in 1971. I was not recruited highly by football teams around the country. I was smoking marijuana on a daily basis. I had only been drunk once or twice in my life by the age of 18. I had had wild trips on orange sunshine. And you know, I got to tell you tonight, I smoked marijuana for 15 years and I don't even like it. Never did like it. I mean, the only thing marijuana ever did for me was make me eat a family-sized bag of Oreos. Ding-dongs or Doritos or four or five cheeseburgers. Red eyes. Every day, every morning. I ended up walking on a small college in Oklahoma called Langston, and I showed up on Wednesday, and I was starting linebacker on Saturday, and I went on for 4 years, made All-America, consensus All-America 3 years, and one of my dreams came true. Well, my first dream was to be All-America. Well, I made All-America my sophomore year. I wanted to make AP All-America. See, I made NAIA All-America. I wanted to be on the Big Boys All-America. Well, that happened too. Me and Too Tall Jones were the All-America defensive ends in 1973. It's really a sad story. I told you my dream came true. And then I wanted to get drafted to the NFL. Well, I not only got drafted, I got drafted in the first round. The Dallas Cowboys. I left home at 15. From a dysfunctional surrounding. At 21, I was in Super Bowl X. 6 years. Just 6 years removed from this dysfunctional shit, I'm in the Super Bowl where a guy is flipping a 200-year-old coin because, you see, America was 200 years old. And he's flipping that coin, and my little street head, I'm thinking, hey, man, I'd sure like to have that coin, man. How's that go pretty good with my 1903 dime? Yeah, I mean, if you're like me, you know, man, you know we save coins and like, oh, this is 1927, you know. A 200-year-old coin? Nothing had changed inside my head and my body. You know, I was a Southern Baptist, and I was baptized a Christian at 6 years old. And, you know, I never stopped being a Christian. I never stopped being a man who believed in Jesus Christ. That's just my belief. I'm not promoting anything here. You know, but I just didn't live that lifestyle because I didn't know how to live their deal because, you see, they told me what to believe and how to believe it. I believed in the concept of God, but I didn't like the way they were teaching it to me. So I stayed away from those people. You see, when I got to the NFL, I didn't know how to live. I had too much money. I was too crazy, too young, and I didn't have any idea of how to live. You see, because I grew up in a house where we moved about 12 times, there was never no home. They never owned a home, so they moved a lot. So consequently, when I got money, matter of fact, when I got drafted to the NFL, I did what most players do. I bought a new car and a stereo system. Of course, I didn't have nowhere to park it or plug it in, but I bought it. During Super Bowl X in Miami, Florida, 1975, I was a young, impressionable young man who didn't know how to live, but I was just checking it out. What's up? What's happening? So I go to a club. Joe Namath owns the club, and there's the Temptations and the Pointer Sisters and all these stars. I sat on the front row of watching the Pointer Sisters show, and I kind of knew, you know. I said, I want one of y'all. Which one? Which one? Let's see. Oh, let's see. She's, ooh. It was four of them then. But one of the things happened to me then was I met something that I would abuse for the next 7-8 years, and that was cocaine. See, the first time I did cocaine, it filled all the holes. It made me all that I wanted to be. The thing about cocaine, it fixed me right now. There was no waiting. And I liked that. I liked cocaine when I first snorted it. I wish I could stand up here tonight and tell the newcomer that it was all bad, but no, it wasn't all bad. It got bad real quick, but I hung in there. I played for a man named Tom Landry. Bald-head fellow, first cousin of God. And he's one of them holier-than-thou kind of people. And I resented everything about Tom Landry because he had everything I wanted. See, he had a wife and a family. He owned a home. He had children that loved him. He had a great job. He had Christianity. He had a higher power. He had faith. And I had none of it. I have no part of it. And so I didn't like him because I didn't have what he had. And I despised what he had because I couldn't figure out why I didn't have it. But I didn't want it. You get that? That's just like an addict, ain't it? So all of my problems and disagreements with Tom Landry were because I resented what he had, all that he had that was good that I didn't have. I didn't have a father. And in 1975, I met that guy who made me. After 21 years, this man had never looked me up, had never called, had never sent a Christmas card, had never sent a tricycle or a truck or nothing. He came into my life, son! I was a cowboy now, see? And of course, as sick as that was, and immediately I knew that me and my father, I knew I didn't like him very much because the first thing we did together was smoke pot. And we smoked pot on his brother's grave, who had been hit in the head with a brick in New York on a dope deal. My next few years in the National Football League were spent snorting cocaine. By the age 25, I had played in 3 Super Bowls. We had won Super Bowl 12. I had friends like Richard Pryor and Marvin Gaye, and the list goes on. People who I call beautiful people. One thing we all had in common is we abused cocaine. And I'm not breaking anybody's anonymity. Everybody knows that already. By age 25, 10 years removed from that dysfunctional place in Austin. Because I haven't come from anywhere but a dysfunctional place, and I haven't found out how to live yet. Maybe you might know how I feel if you're sitting here tonight, that you didn't know how to live until you got here and heard how other people were living. Because your parents had done the best thing they knew to do. My mother and father passed on to me what was passed on to them. I forgive them. I don't have no adult children of alcoholic issues. Every issue I got, I can take care of in the 12 steps of this program. Because if I get to going all in programs, see, I'd be 24 hours a day in everything. Because I'm a little bit of everything. Ain't nothing these 12 steps can't work out. I don't believe. If there's something that can't work out, I don't want it. I don't want it. 5 years as a Dallas Cowboy, my life got out of control. My life got, as we say in these rooms, unmanageable. I think Bill Cosby said it best, said, you know, oh yeah, cocaine enhanced my personality. So, well, what if you're an asshole? Well, I was an asshole. It enhanced my assholism. You see, I have friends today, and I didn't have friends back then. I just had people who liked me because of the cocaine I had, or because I was Hollywood Henderson, or because I was a Dallas Cowboy. Something beside the true sense of friendship. You know, because my friends back then, you ever had friends like this? Yeah, my friends would steal my dope and help me look for it. You bet? Hey, man, I think it's over here. Man, you look over here? You look under the couch? You know what I'm talking about, don't you? The Monday before Thanksgiving 1979, Tom Landry had enough of my antics because they didn't know who was coming to work the next day. See, by now my nose is completely torn up. I have snorted so much cocaine that the middle of my nose is gone. Bye-bye, see you later. I built a shower in my home that cost me several thousand dollars, a steam room for my nose, because this thing in the middle of my nose would come out ever so often. And I would have to, you know, put salt water and Vicks inhalers and all this shit in my nose, man, just to maintain it, you know. It became maintenance. I quit enjoying cocaine after a while, and it became an addictive trip to keep my nose from hurting, to keep the tears from welling in my eye, because I destroyed the septum in the middle of my nose. About once a week, I would get in my shower, and as blood ran down my chest, across my belly button, into my pubic hairs, from the gush out of my nose, I would blow my nose very hard to the wall in my shower, blood splatting on the wall, and this thing would come out and hit the wall and slide down into the tub. And if it had had legs, it had crawled off. That is called a booger. And it was according to how long it had been in there, whether I picked it up and ate it or not. because I have blown my nose so many nights and said, that's $40. I'm here to tell you the truth. I'm not here to tell you what you want to hear. I have boogers under people's couches today. I have rubbed boogers at people's carpet. It's so nice to be sober and talk about it today. Tom Landry fired me. And it was a pretty profound meeting we had. As I sat there with my nose packed with cocaine, he was trying to be nice to me. Thomas, this is the toughest thing I've ever had to do. He said, I've never let a player go the 12th game of the season. He said, but I do not know what to do with you. And I sat back across from him and said, I don't know what to do with you either. Excuse me. I was so addicted at that time that it didn't matter what he did. I was addicted to cocaine. Those of you who are here tonight know what I'm talking about when I say I was addicted to cocaine. It had done me pretty bad, and I was feeling awfully bad, but, you know, it's that lonely place that gets us here, I believe, that we want to quit, but we don't know how. That dilemma hits us right between the eyes. That we say we're not going to do it again, and we do it again. That's the loneliest place I've ever been, is wanting to quit, not knowing how. So he fired me. And of course, being the cocaine addict that I was at the time, I said, oh, excuse me, you can't fire me, I quit. I retire. So I officially retired from pro football at 26 years old. Well, it wasn't but 2 weeks passed, I started thinking, oh shit, I'm snorting all this coke, I need money. I said, I want to come back. And they said, too late. So I was out for the rest of the year, but I got paid. Several people came to see me during that 4 weeks before the year ended in Dallas. They met me in parking lots like they were from the mafia, and they parked their car across the parking lot, and I meet them in the middle of the parking lot, and I stand there, and these were high officials in the Cowboy organization, and they would say to me, you know, Thomas, it's out that you're doing that, and you need to do something about it. And I go, well, man, I don't know where you're getting that information from, but it ain't true. And they would go back to their car, and I would get back in my car, and I would cry. I would cry because I was hurting real bad. And I knew they were right, but I knew I couldn't quit. I didn't. How am I going to quit? They made it sound so simple, like you got to quit. I didn't know how to quit. I didn't know where this room was. So that year ended, and I did not quit. And I got traded to the San Francisco 49ers. Nobody told Bill Walsh he was getting a cocaine addict up in San Francisco. So I showed up in San Francisco. They gave me a bunch of money, and I went out in free base for about, oh, 5-6 days and came to work, came to the training camp. And I had my helmet on, all strapped to my chin, and my shoulder pads, and my knee, and everything, and my shoes. Number 50 in San Francisco. And I was on the ground. I stretched my hamstring. Then I laid back and stretched my quad. And then I went to sleep. I'm probably one of the only football players in the history of the game to go to sleep in the middle of practice. Well, they released me the next day. And of course, they traded me to the Houston Oilers. But nobody told Bum Phillips he was getting a cocaine addict. So I practiced about 20 minutes and said, "Oh, my leg is hurting." And I was on injured reserve for 11 weeks, and they paid me $150,000 just to, you know, go in and get ice on the back of my leg, and I go free base. I didn't tell you how I started free base, and I don't need to tell you. You know, wherever there's coke to be snorted, there's coke to be based. But after 1980, the pain got too bad. I was just hurting. My life was unmanageable. I was spending thousands of dollars. I was alone because I was using a loan. I had a Doberman. I was getting my dog fucked up. My roommate, Too Tall Jones, he moved away from me. I was alone, and I didn't know why I was alone, because you know why I was alone? Nobody did it like I did it. I had nobody who did it like I did it. People used to leave me in motel rooms, and while they were closing the door, they'd look back and say, "Hey man, you're going to die." I don't understand people who leave the dope. I don't understand that. I never could. So in January 1981, I called Pete Rozelle, and I said, "Pete, I'm a coke addict. This cocaine's about to kill me, and I'm addicted to this stuff. Will you give me some help?" So they sent me to treatment in Arizona. Went over to a place there called Camelback Hospital. Stayed 60 days, had nose surgery, fixed my nose. I was sure this program was going to fix me. And I felt fixed. You know, I drank beer and everything through the program, but I didn't think that meant anything. I remember a friend of mine coming to get me out of treatment. He drove my car over from Dallas. I had a black Mercedes Benz, smoke windows, sunroof, the whole deal. And we started across the desert, headed back to Texas, and I rented my glove compartment. I just got out of treatment, 64 days, good treatment, good intense treatment for cocaine addiction. And I rolled me a big fat joint, and I looked at my friend, lit it up, I said, "Yeah, I think this program's going to work." I was back to cocaine within hours. By the time I got to Dallas, 24 hours, I was back on coke. And it was downhill from there. By February 1982, I was broke, homeless. I spent everything. I'd lost the Super Bowl rings. Everything was gone because I give it away to cocaine. And I had the same thing going out of football that I had going in. A car and a stereo system with nowhere to park it and nowhere to plug it in. In 1982, I became an alcoholic because it was cheaper. I started drinking Tanqueray and tonic. 83, I moved to California, Long Beach, California. Any of you read my book or read the newspaper know that I was charged with sexual misconduct. Said I had sex with a 15-year-old girl while we freebased cocaine. It's true. I had nothing to do with anybody who was disabled or that deal. What was true was enough. And it was my emotional bottom. It was my spot. So I was ready to go on home. I was ready to go ahead and leave this place because I had fallen too far to ever lift my head again. What is Thomas Henderson going to do now? So I wanted to kill myself. And the only reason I didn't kill myself is because I was afraid I'd be successful in it. The doctor told me that suicide was a permanent solution for a temporary problem. He told me I could get over anything. I went into treatment in November 1983 at the care unit in Orange, California. I was facing jail, prison, humiliation, moral charges. What really happened was bad enough, but to add all the other little things on top of it were a little embarrassing. And it still is a little embarrassing because if you hear it from me, I'll tell you that when I freebased cocaine, I didn't care what was going on. Sex was part of my deal. And if you're anything like me, sex is part of your deal. And anybody freebasing cocaine, that whole arena is slavery. You do what you got to do to get a hit, don't you? I did. I went into treatment. And I didn't think I was going to make it. My first few days in the program, I heard people saying they had 5-6 years. It was an Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a Cocaine Anonymous meeting in Newport Beach, California on 32nd Street, the first meeting in Orange County. And that's my home group. You see, this past November 8th, I celebrated 5 years clean and sober. I went through treatment for 42 days. Then I went to another treatment program for 60 days. And in that 7 months, because after I left the other program, I moved to Laguna Beach, I moved into a house where I had a little room. I had a car. But, you know, I'm going to show you how it works in these rooms. See, nobody asked me for my autograph when I first got sober. I was a little concerned with that. But one of my first vehicles was a little Datsun 210. Now, to show you how it was, the car was worth, I paid $200 for it, and I owed on it. I'd make a payment on a $200 note, you know. But one thing I did, I went to meetings 3, sometimes 4 times a day for 7 months. I went to over 500 meetings. It was my job to stay sober. That was the only job I had. You see, I had to go to meetings the way I used, and that was all day long. Some people say do 90 meetings in 90 days. Well, if I sponsor somebody, I got to tell them to do it the way I did it. I need 90 meetings in 30 days. People go, well, I don't want you to be my sponsor. Thank you very much. 7 months sober, I went to prison on those charges. Well, because at about 4 months sober, I got a deal in my head that I could fix it. Money always fixed things. So I came into some money, and I went to one of the girls, and I said, look, you know, what do you want, man? You know this. So I offered $10,000, and they gave my money to the police, and I got arrested again. So I got charged with bribery of the court. So I had to plead no contest to the charges, which I didn't like very much. And I got sentenced to 2 years and 4 months in prison. Some of you may say, God, man, that was rough. Well, some people think I got punished. I like to look at it like I was rescued. Because what 2 years and 4 months did for me was gave me a time to learn how to live. You see, I took my big book and my 12 and 12 to prison with me. If you got jail time to do here tonight, some of you newcomers, if you're here because the court sent you here, it's okay. Just keep coming back. And keep coming back when you get out. For 2 years and 4 months, I had a unique opportunity to study the program.
And how can this program work in my life? I'm bright, I'm smart. I need to figure this thing out because I want to know how to live. For 2 years and 4 months, I became a student of my program, this program, these 12 steps, these promises are happening in my life. I celebrated my first AA birthday in prison. I celebrated my second AACA birthday in prison. I celebrated my third birthday in prison. Good meeting, too. I celebrated my fourth year at home. I celebrated my fifth year at home. And it's wonderful. Sobriety is profound. Sobriety is wonderful. I believe sobriety is about action. For me, it is. Because you're looking at a guy who had a moral charge, who was a has-been football player, who has friends today, who makes a living today, and it didn't seem like that was at all possible because of our society being so moral conscious. Today I know how to be successful, but I also know how to handle it. Because sobriety has given me something that nobody else has ever given me. The 12 steps have given me something that no one else has ever given me, and it's something that's mine. My 12 steps are mine. The way I work them is mine. My sobriety is mine. It's the only honest thing I've ever done in my life. My sobriety is the only honest thing I've ever... In other words, if you've been sober honestly, you got to be proud where you live, and that's deep down. I'm grateful I'm sober. I'm not so grateful that I'm an alcoholic, though. I mean, deep down in my gut there, I don't like to be an alcoholic. I never intended to be. I don't think anybody here ever intended to be a dope addict. I don't remember pulling on my mother's apron and saying, "Mother, you know what I want to be when I grow up, Mother?" "Well, what, son? An alcoholic?" I think in sobriety, results are pretty important. I feel like for the last 5 years, I've walked around with a broom and a dustpan, cleaning up the wreckage of my past. Because I feel like if you don't clean up the wreckage, something's always going to be missing in your sobriety. You can't push it aside or forget about it. We got to work through it. We got to recognize it. You see people in the rooms, man, who it never seems to get any better for them. They're working through economic hardship, and they're not working. The guy comes to me and say, "Oh, man, I'm having really some economic insecurity." "Well, why?" "Oh, I'm not working." So, you see, because when we start getting sober, I believe, and we want to go for our goals or do things, it's okay. We don't have to be afraid to go back and be husbands. We don't have to be afraid to go back and be professors or construction workers or teachers or doctors or lawyers or whatever we are. We can't be afraid to go on back and get into the real world. See, there's life after the program. Relationships. I'm married. Sometimes it's tough in a relationship. It's not always easy. But I love my wife, and we're buddies and we're friends, but that don't mean we still can't have some problems in our relationship. My friend is in town. My sponsor, Jimmy Daniels. And I love this. Stand up, man, please. I love this. This is my sponsor, Jimmy Daniels. If you'd have told me 5 years ago that I'd have Jimmy Dan's my sponsor, I'd have shot you in the head. We went to Tijuana today and got grateful. Sobriety is profound. If a guy like me, Thomas Henderson, can be clean and sober, anybody can. You gotta want it, you gotta want it every day. You see, the thing I've done in my program is I work step one every single day. 100%. You can't get a 95 on step one. Because if you're clean, you've done it 100%. You can get C's and D's on those other steps, but you'll come around. I promise you one thing. If you work step one, 100%, that's the clean step, you won't use drugs or alcohol anymore. Now, if you want to get your life together, you'll go on and try to take some other steps. Because you can, as my friend says, you know, be a year sober, unmarred by a single day of growth. Yeah, because even in my sobriety, man, I've been dry sometimes. Anybody ever been dry? You know, I'm kind of like a fire hazard. You know what I mean? My sponsor, Jimmy Daniels, told me, if you can't practice these principles in all your affairs, better change some of your affairs. I've got to tell you tonight, my sobriety is real. I'm real. I am truly grateful for Live at 5, Cocaine Anonymous, to have me come down here. It's always my pleasure because I do this kind of stuff for a living. Although I can't talk about program when I talk at high schools and colleges and different places I speak around the country. But this is my way of giving it back. And I want to put in a plug for Cocaine Anonymous. That in July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in New York City at the Grand Hyatt on 42nd Street, Cocaine Anonymous World Convention, I'm going to be the Saturday night speaker. Hey, that's if I make it. You know what I'm saying? You know, I believe we have to be optimistic in our sobriety. You know, because you'll talk to people in the program, they'll go, just one day at a time. But does that mean I can't have layaway, goddammit? I mean, can I put something in layaway, asshole? That's too pessimistic. I believe optimism comes along with good sobriety. I think we need to encourage optimistic sobriety. It has to be fun. Can't be that painful. I was at a meeting in Laguna, a speaker meeting. A guy took a 13-year case. You know, he stood up there, and I'm sitting there, and, you know, I got about 4 months. I'm sitting there listening to this guy speak. I'm wanting to be the speaker, of course. And just like all of you out there right now, I know that you're thinking, I would love to be the speaker. It's just normal. But this guy was talking, getting his birthday cake, and he said, you know, this 13 years have been real tough, and I wanted to commit suicide and everything. I was sitting there thinking, God, when I get to 12 years, I'm going to drink. I ain't going to try to get that 13th year, man. Results. That's what you see with good sobriety, is results. You see, I get results today because I'm responsible. I'm reliable. I have self-credibility, something you can't buy. I'm responsible today. Sobriety is profound. I really do love each and every one of you. I'm grateful you had me down here to talk. I'm glad I'm sober enough to talk. And I have my sponsor here tonight, so I wouldn't lie. Try to be too profound. But we do see results in sobriety. And if we're not getting results in sobriety, we need to work on our program a little more. We need to encourage people into results. I love every one of you, and this has felt real good. And I feel real good right now, and I know God has done what He needs to do tonight. Thank you for letting me share.